MacCast, Monday, May 19th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I don't often talk about what's going on in my life. I try and keep things about the Mac and Apple on the podcast, but last week was a little bit interesting around here. It got a little bit crazy toward the end of the week. You may or may not have heard we had some pretty serious fires here in San Diego. Some of you know that I'm in the San Diego, Southern California area. As a matter of fact, the fires got a little too close for comfort for me. Just a couple miles away, but I wanted to let everybody know who was following along on Twitter and things like that, that everything is okay. They were about 2 miles or so from my house. I actually put some pictures up on my Flickr if you want to take a look. Pretty scary stuff. Had neighbors and friends evacuated. Luckily, the fire folks here are amazing, did an amazing job of protecting homes and protecting lives. And as far as I know, there were some homes and structures lost, but I don't think there were any serious injuries or deaths due to the fire, at least none that I'm aware of at this point. So I just wanted to let everybody know up front that everything is okay and we're kind of back to normal. Everything has subsided. But thank you to everyone who sent me an email or said something on Twitter or Facebook or what have you. I just wanted to give that quick update. But we do have some Mac news and things to get into, although I was looking through the notes this week and there is not a lot. There's not a whole lot going on. I think we're kind of in that little bit of a lull as we lead up to WWDC. Still a lot of rumors about the iPhone 6 and what have you. Also a little bit of updates on the rumored Beats acquisition, those sorts of things. And then I got some great feedback from you on things like the NFC chip and pin kind of stuff. And then I had a few questions and things from you to address, including looking at fixing up iTunes album art. So we're going to jump into all of that stuff here in a minute. Before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Sanebox. And I have to tell you, I found out about Sanebox from my friend David Sparks over at Mac Power Users. Actually, he talks about it in his Mac Sparky Field Guide on email. Great book if you haven't picked it up. But, you know, if you're like me, you get a ton of email, probably too much, and your inbox kind of fills up. And there's been all kinds of tips and tricks and tools for sort of managing your inbox and getting to that whole inbox zero thing. But what Sanebox does that I particularly love is it cleans out your email inbox, sort of pre-filters it so that what you end up with is just the important emails, the stuff that you really need to pay attention to, and it kind of takes everything else and puts it out of the way until you can get to it. So it moves those unimportant emails out of your inbox, puts them into these separate folders, and then gives you a summary each day, sort of a digest, and says, here's the stuff that I moved you might want to go take a look at. But when you go to look at your inbox, you only have those things that you really care about. And it does it in a real ingenious way. It works with any email provider. Doesn't matter the client you're using, your device. It's very simple to set up. It just creates these extra sane box folders. So you have a sane later and a sane bulk email. You can kind of pick and choose the ones that you want and tailor the service to what you really need. And then it just watches your email coming in, and it also watches your behavior. It watches the kinds of things that you respond to, how quickly you respond, and then builds a sort of smart profile of how you access your email, and then can filter everything out. And also, if it accidentally misfiles something, all you have to do is drag it into the appropriate box, and it'll remember those sorts of things too. So every once in a while, something will show up in my Sane Later folder that I really want in my inbox. I just move that, and then the next time an email or something comes in from that person, it's going to remember that behavior. So it analyzes your past behavior and kind of keeps track of all that. So setup is super, super simple, and they're adding new features all the time. They recently added one that I absolutely love called Sane Not Spam. And those are for those things, you know, you get emails and your system thinks it's spam, but it's really not spam. It will watch for that sort of stuff and throw things that it thinks this might be spam, but maybe it isn't based on your behavior. It puts it into that folder. And that's enabled me to actually capture some emails that I would have missed before. They would have went to my spam folder and I would have totally missed them. So great stuff like that. It's really, really cool. I want you to check out, and it has a ton of other features. One I just want to point out is it has the ability to snooze your non-urgent emails. So if you have an email that comes in, but you know you need to respond to it in a day, in a week, or some sort of other custom time frame, you can set up folders for that. So you just move it, drop it over there, and it will show back up in your inbox in that period of time. So great for sort of delaying responses and making sure that you sort of get that reminder, oh yeah, I need to respond to that in a couple days or next week, something like that. It can also move all your email attachments automatically into your Dropbox folder. Really great stuff. And you can try it for free. Plus, when you sign up, because you're a MacCast listener, you can get a $10 credit. All you have to do is go to sanebox.com/MacCast. That's SaneBox.com/MacCast. You can get all the details and you will get your $10 credit when you sign up for Sanebox. I love the service. Now that I have it, I can't imagine life without it. And I want to give a big thank you to Sanebox for their support of the MacCast. One of the big stories from a week or so ago was the rumor that Apple was going to be acquiring Beats, the headphone and music streaming service, for $3.2 billion. And that was supposed to become official sometime this week. Obviously, that hasn't happened yet. There's still the rumors floating around out there. A couple new updates related to that rumor have surfaced. One is that some sources are claiming that Apple might announced Dr. Dre, who is one of the founders of Beats. His real name is actually Andre Young, and Jimmy Iovine. And I apologize last time for totally mutilating his name. I knew the correct pronunciation. I just had this habit of pronouncing it incorrectly. Jimmy Iovine. They might announce both of them as new Apple executives during WWDC, which is coming up here in early June. So they might bring them out on stage and introduce them as new executives. One of the rumors I read said that they would still both be based out of LA and sort of commute as needed up to Cupertino to kind of play their role in the company. And nobody really knows exactly if they are brought on board, if this whole deal happens, what exactly their various roles are going to be. One thing is that Jimmy Iovine has a lot of connections into the music industry. So I'm sure it's going to be something related to that capacity. Probably the same thing for Andre Young, Dr. Dre as well. There was also a leaked royalty report that surfaced. One of the questions has been, you know, what is Apple buying Beats for and why are they spending so much money on it? One thing that's been floated around is that they want the streaming music service, the Beats streaming music service, which supposedly has some really nice features, especially in terms of like curated artist playlists and things like that. But still, there were kind of indications that the actual number of subscribers to the Beats music service was relatively small. I think one of the numbers that was being thrown around was around 220,000 paid subscribers on the Beats service. So it didn't seem that the price Apple was rumored to be paying for Beats was going to justify sort of the cost just to acquire maybe the subscribers of that service. Well, a leaked royalty report from a musician website came out this past week, and it seemed to show that the numbers were even more bleak for the Beats music service. It seemed to indicate that it looked like there was around 110, almost 111,000 paid subscribers, 110,992, which is really, really small. So if this is about sort of acquiring the Beats music service, it has to be more about the technology and the engineers and things like that. I think I mentioned in the last episode that I really think this is more of an aggregate sort of thing. I think Apple's getting a lot of bits and pieces. There's a lot of angles to this whole deal. But for me, it's still not sort of adding up to that 3.2 billion number. And unfortunately, even if the deal does become official and gets done, we will never really know. It'll never be publicly reported exactly what was paid. But speculation is in the multi-billions of dollars. Might be a little bit lower, I would have to imagine. I can't imagine Apple paying that much. But Recode, as far as why we haven't heard anything yet, Recode is reporting that the deal is still pending and might not happen till next week. They weren't really clear on what the source of the delay was, but even when the deal is finally announced, it's expected it will take a couple months to kind of finalize the acquisition and, you know, sort out all that paperwork and legal stuff. I can only imagine what's going on behind the scenes, but still really is puzzling that sort of figure, and no one really knows why Apple would pay that much. You've got the hardware side, you've got the streaming music side. If you have any of your own personal theories, I'd love to hear them. You can shoot me an email or send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. A lot of people now are speculating what the next version of iOS is going to look like. iOS 8, it's expected that we'll get a little bit of a preview at WWDC. Well, this week, Mark Gurman over at 9to5 Mac says that his sources are telling him that iOS 8 is finally going to bring a new split-screen multitasking feature to the iPad. This is something that Apple had sort of railed against, or not really railed against, but sort of discounted as a feature that was necessary in tablets. They really have always supported this concept that you want the full screen and you want to work one app at a time on an iPad-style device. So this would totally go against that. We've seen Apple's competitors in Android, and actually Microsoft had some commercials specifically touting the fact that they could do multiple windows on the iPad. A lot of people have said they would want this kind of feature in the iPad. I personally am not convinced it's something that I would be using a whole lot. The iPad screen at 9.7 inches doesn't seem to have enough real estate to me to want to be able to run apps side by side, but this would allow you to run two applications at the same time. They're saying it's specifically designed for the 9.7 inch iPad display, and it's unclear if the feature would work on even the smaller sized iPads, if it would be something that would be in the iPad mini or not at this point. And it's also being said that it would work exclusively in the landscape mode, which I think makes a lot of sense. When you're in portrait mode, if you're going to split the screen in half, that's not going to give you, I guess if you went top to bottom, maybe it could work that way. But they're saying right now the feature is looking to be landscape mode only. And it might be partly, I think, a precursor to a feature that makes a lot more sense if Apple brings out that rumored larger screened iPad, something in that 11, 12 inch range, or maybe even 13 inch. The latest on that has been that the 12 inch iPad, the iPad, what some people are dubbing the iPad Pro, has been delayed until at least early 2015. So that's not expected to come out this year. Although I did see, I think just this past week, some reports still saying that they think possibly Apple could bring it out toward the end of this year. I don't think that's very likely. But if we did have a larger screen to iPad and iPad Pro, maybe some of these concepts or designs around having a split screen mode or being able to run multiple apps simultaneously might make a little bit more sense. I've personally never had a problem with the whole multitasking feature, the, you know, double tapping and the app switching, or using the swipe gesture, the four-finger swipe gesture, to sort of jump back and forth between apps. I've gotten pretty familiar with that dynamic. And as a matter of fact, I think I commented on the latest We Have Communicators podcast that when I'm working on my 15-inch laptop, I now prefer to go into full screen mode one app at a time and just fast switch between full screen modes between my different apps. So if I'm copying and pasting data between different applications, some have argued that it would be nice to be able to have maybe your email up sort of on one side of the screen. And some design concepts have been surfaced where if Apple does go with a split screen mode, you'd be able to not just have it 50-50 on your screen. You might be able to slide the divider back and forth and make some apps smaller or larger depending. So again, this is one of those features that I'd be curious to know what you think. Is this something that you've been clamoring for? If this was a big feature in iOS 8, would it be a huge reason for you to upgrade on your iPad? It seems like if they do launch it, they're launching it in a limited capacity, only targeting the 9.7 inch. So maybe it won't be that big of a deal for that many users. The iPad mini is pretty popular. Would it even make sense on an iPad mini? It brings up a lot of questions, but it is something that's interesting to think about. Some other iOS related rumors. Mac Otakahara is claiming that iOS 8 will have support for high definition audio playback. Some think that this might play into the whole Beats thing, the Beats acquisition, specifically on the hardware side. Apple might be able to better control high definition music, higher quality music on iTunes, and couple that in with the hardware in their devices, iPhones and iPod touches, things like that, and then marry that to the headphone hardware. So you could have all kinds of interesting things going on with digital signal processing and the chips, and you can kind of control end to end that whole high end, high definition music experience. To me, that seems like a lot of technology for a very small segment of the market. So I'm a little bit curious about that. But where this rumor is coming from is, I guess iOS software currently is not capable of playing 24-bit tracks at a sample rate greater than 48 kilohertz. And to audio files, that's a real deficiency. They want to see the quality and the fidelity of music, digital music specifically, going up into a higher quality, and this would be bringing that kind of technology into the iOS ecosystem. iOS 8 will not reportedly, though, be the massive update and redesign like we saw with iOS 7. A lot of people are equating it more to what we saw with OS 10 Mavericks on the desktop, sort of the next iteration of the current operating system. We can expect some nice refinements and maybe some new applications. We had been hearing about text edit and preview apps coming into the iOS ecosystem. That's a kind of meh for me. I'm not super excited about that, and I'm not putting a lot of stock into that happening. Of course, we've heard a lot about the HealthBook application, which would play into whatever Apple is doing with the iWatch or the wearable market. We've seen so many acquisitions in the health and sensor field from Apple in terms of employee hires recently that seems to make a lot of sense. I don't think that's something that we're going to see demoed or shown off at WWDC because it has such a tie-in into the hardware, and I don't think we're going to hear anything about an iWatch in terms of hardware or an Apple wearable until sometime in the fall. So they may have some private meetings at WWDC with maybe some key players and partners on the software side, apps that might integrate or hook into HealthBook, but I think those are all going to happen behind closed doors. Something I'm pretty excited about, and we've been hearing more, is that Apple's going to put some focus on iCloud. I'm really hoping that they're going to make it better and easier for developers to use and work with. Apple really needs to get their whole cloud, especially documents in the cloud, iCloud documents, whatever they call it. See, I can't even remember what they call it. Documents in the cloud, I think, is what they call it for iCloud. They need to get that all better integrated. They need to get more app developers using it, and they've had so many fumbles and problems that I think most app developers are sticking with third-party solutions like Dropbox or Transporter or some other solution to kind of get things done. As a matter of fact, you know, the folks over at Omni wrote their own Omnipresence, their own thing for kind of handling cloud-based documents. That kind of gives you an indication of the kind of mess that things are in. So any focus Apple can put on iCloud and iOS 8 and better integration, I think, is going to be a really good thing. We've also heard those rumors of transit directions coming back into Maps. I think that's going to be a welcome addition for a lot of people. And then overall, just speed and performance improvements, as well as tiny enhancements and little tweaks to the user interface. And I think those are going to be really nice. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of really big, huge key point features, but I think we are going to see a large volume of enhancements and refinements. I'm really hoping that we'll see some better Siri integration, specifically with third-party apps, maybe even a Siri API opening up, although I haven't heard too many rumors surrounding that. But we can expect some pretty interesting things going on, I think, with iOS 8 at WWDC here in a couple weeks. Now let's talk about the iPhone 6 and when it's going to be launched. There have been a lot of people who think that Apple is going to be actually launching two versions of the iPhone 6, two staggered launches of the Gigantophone. I think personally that they're going to be disappointed, but if you think that there's going to be actually two different devices, a 4.7 and a 5.5, I'm not expecting that to happen this year. But keep in mind, I have been wrong a lot. So don't put too much stock in what I'm thinking, because the rumors are all pointing to there actually being two devices. Many are saying that Apple's going to have both a 4.7 inch and a 5.5 inch. We heard earlier that the 4.7 inch would be here in the fall and the 5.5 inch would be sometime later in the year. That's a little bit of why I'm not putting too much stock in this rumor, because if Apple wants to have something out for the holiday selling season, they're going to have to launch it in the early fall. I don't think people are going to hold off till late in the year to buy their new iPhone. They're going to want something for the holidays, something to put under the tree, something for Hanukkah, whatever you might celebrate. But more and more, there's that crazy rumor that the 4.7 inch will be here in August and that the 5.5 could be coming in September. So that was kind of floated around last week, that we were going to get a little bit earlier launch, and then the 4.7, and then the 5.5 would be in September. So that might make a little more sense, except that there's now a leak saying, and this is out of Germany, that Apple retail employees there are having restricted time off for the month of September. This is usually a sign that Apple is doing some sort of product launch during that month, and the iPhone 6, that would be the one that would make the most sense for that sort of time frame. So it's really looking like we're going to see a September release date, sometime in September, of the new iPhone 6, and I think that's going to be simply just the 4.7-inch model. Apple's only going to have one size this year, and maybe there's a larger screened iPhone and a 5.5, but I fully expect that to happen as the iPhone 7, I would assume, not just a larger 6. But again, I've been wrong before. As far as the actual dimensions of the screen size, we started to get a little more details of that this week. Some rumors coming out saying that it's going to be 1704 by 960 resolution, and that's interesting for a couple different reasons. One is that it's going to maintain that 16 by 9 aspect ratio that Apple has introduced in the latest iPhones. It also means that it's going to have a pixel density of about 416 pixels per inch, again, assuming we get a 4.7-inch display with that resolution. That would be well above the 300 pixels per inch that Apple requires for the Retina designation, so that keeps it in as a Retina display. Spec-wise, though, that pixel density is going to be a little bit low compared to some of Apple's competitors of late, and really falls short of a true 1080p resolution, which some of the other phones and devices are coming out with. That's 1920 by 1080. Personally, I think it doesn't matter. It's really a silly spec, I think, for a screen size that small. You're really not going to notice that kind of resolution on a 4-inch, 5-inch sort of screen. And the reason 1704 by 960 is that basically is three times the resolution, the pixel width of the original, of the iPhone 4, I think it was. So that means that there's only going to have to be about a 50% upscaling of the resolution for non-optimized apps. So you remember when we went from the original iPhone screen to the pixel doubled screen, and we were able to run apps in that sort of 2x mode, and they kind of got all little fuzzy and things like that, but it worked. Same kind of thing going on here. Apple would be able to bring out the iPhone 6 at this resolution, and then any apps that weren't re-engineered or redesigned to take full native advantage of that resolution would be able to be scaled up, and then you would only have to do about a 50% upscaling from the current assets that are there. So it would actually look better than the 2x upscaling that we had in the past. So that makes a lot of sense when it comes to the screen resolution. So it's likely to fall into that range, I think. We also got word on who actually might be the supplier of the, or rather the third supplier of those 4.7-inch displays. And surprisingly, it might be a Taiwanese LCD manufacturer, Innolux, and not Sharp or Samsung. The rumor came out of the Taiwanese supply chain, and as Tim Cook warned, we need to kind of be careful about any rumors coming out of the supply chain. But if it's true, the theory is that Apple is leery about continuing to hand Samsung more of its business in the wake of all the different lawsuits and sort of the troubles that they've had with Samsung. So they want to be pulling back from Samsung. And so they didn't go with Samsung for these new LCDs for that reason. I think that's a pretty weak rumor, considering that Samsung is still providing the majority of the chips for Apple's iOS devices. So I don't think Apple's that leery about doing deals with Samsung. So it's probably some other factor if this rumor turns out to be true. It's also said that they didn't go with Sharp, which is another LCD supplier Apple's used in the past, because of quality issues during preliminary test runs of the new panels. So Apple has had some supply issues with Sharp in the past, and that would give them a little bit more pause, especially if they were having some issues during the initial testing of the new displays. So looking like Innolux is going to be that third supplier along with LG Display and Japan Display as the three suppliers of the new 4.7-inch panel for the iPhone 6. And as I said earlier, there's still rumors, heavy, heavy rumors, that there's going to be a 5.5-inch version of the iPhone 6. I just hope, actually, that if that is the case, when Apple does the iPhone 6 announcement, that they pre-announce that they're going to have a larger screen version later in the fall. Otherwise, I think they're going to have some very remorseful iPhone 4.7-inch buyers on their hands. And I think PR-wise and just overall, that's not going to be a very good thing for Apple. You don't put out a brand new device, get a bunch of people to buy that device, and then suddenly go a couple months later, hey, here's another new iPhone. I know other vendors do that and sort of come out with new models. I don't think months apart. Usually it's three. You got to give people some sort of time frame, some sort of indicator that you're going to have some other device. So I guess I could see that happening if Apple pre-announces it, but I think that's going to negatively impact probably the iPhone 4.7-inch sales, and just something historically Apple hasn't done. But it is a new Apple under Tim Cook. We've seen a lot of new sort of behavior this year, including things like potentially spending $3.2 billion on an acquisition that would be more than Apple's ever spent on a company before. So if these sorts of things come to true, we really do have a new Apple on our hands. And I guess maybe all bets are off in terms of our rumors. We're going to have to kind of reevaluate things. But only time will tell, and we'll have to wait for the official announcements from Apple before we can really make any call on that. Looks like there is a bit of trouble for you if you are an iMessage user and an iOS device user and you want to move over to Android. A little bug is kind of biting a few people, including an ex-Lifehacker editor, a guy named Adam Pash. He found out recently when switching from iOS to Android that text messages from his iPhone-owning friends were not showing up on his new device. And he did a little bit of tracking down, did some calls to Apple, and found out that what was going on is the iPhone owners were sending him iMessages to his new Android device, and obviously that's not going to work. Unfortunately, they were seeing the text messages as being successfully sent, but Adam actually never got them. And the problem seems to be that the phone number was still registered with iMessage, so iMessage is apparently still happily sending them through the iMessage system rather than the standard SMS system, which means Adam actually never gets them. So the more troubling part of the story is that after working with AppleCare for a while, he said that they even admitted and said that a lot of people are having this issue, and that more disturbingly, they are really unsure, or rather Apple's engineers are unsure exactly how to solve it. Now, if you remember from a couple years ago when Apple first launched iMessage, this issue has been around for a while. We had that whole report of stolen iPhones that were stolen and then disabled, disactivated, and people getting new iPhones to replace those stolen iPhones, they would find that their iMessages were still going to the old devices. So people would acquire the devices that were stolen for whatever reason, you know, buy them on eBay or wherever they got fenced, and they would find out that they were getting the iMessages or text messages of the previous owner, even though that phone had been disabled, disactivated, and then reactivated again. Apple really needs to address this problem. They need to be able to do something on the back end within the iMessage system to actually fix this. But for now, it looks like there isn't really a way to do it, or actually, we kind of know of some ways from the issue a couple years ago. I talked about this on the show. There are some things that you can do, but you kind of have to be proactive about doing them. You have to kind of deregister all your devices with the iMessage system before you get your new device. So one of the things that you can do is you can, on your device, go into the iOS settings, into messages, and then under send and receive, make sure that you uncheck the phone number under the section you can be reached by iMessage at. So that will basically deregister that phone number from the iMessage system. You can do a similar thing on the Mac through the messages preferences, you click on the accounts tab, and then you can select your iMessage account, and you can uncheck that number. But probably a better way to do it is to completely turn off iMessage on all of your devices before you get new ones. And the way you do that is you go into settings, messages, and there's a little toggle box for iMessages, and you can just simply toggle that to off on your device. Same thing on the Mac, there's a checkbox that says enable this account. Just disable that iMessage account and get it off of your Mac. So if you're selling your Mac, you probably want to do that. If you're going to replace your iOS device, you're going to want to make sure that you totally disable iMessage. Now, if you didn't do that and you got a new device, if you've been hit by this problem, maybe you have a new Android device or Windows phone, and you're suddenly noticed you're not getting text messages or SMS messages from your friends who you were using iMessage with in the past who have iOS devices, one thing you can try is going into your support profile at Apple. So if you go to supportprofile.apple.com and log in, you can click on the little edit products option. Again, this is only going to work if you've registered your devices with your Apple ID and you still have access to that Apple ID. But if you can get into your support profile and you have your devices registered, you can click the little X to the right of your product, the old iPhone that you got rid of, and click the unregister button. So you can unregister it with Apple, which in some cases I think will take it out of the whole iMessage system. So that might be able to disable that device from iMessage and get your text messages flowing again, or those messages that are falsely being sent to iMessage flowing again. So that's another thing that you can try. But probably the best method is if you know you're going to be replacing your iOS device, and I would do this even if you're planning on getting another iOS device, you might want to just turn off iMessage on the current device before you sell it, because it looks like it's doing something to lock in the hardware ID, maybe the phone number, to the iMessage system, and Apple doesn't apparently have any way to reset that after the fact from the back end of their system. Like I said, long term, they're going to absolutely have to address this. And it's just cropping up again and again. And apparently Apple's aware of it, but just doesn't have a fix at the moment. And then the last thing in the news for this week, actually a number of things, a bunch of updates from Apple for OS X, iTunes, and podcasts. Let's start things off with OS X Mavericks. OS X Mavericks 10.9.3 came out, and it improves support for 4K displays on Apple's new Mac Pro systems. If you remember when it originally came out, the Mac Pro had limited support for 4K displays, so that has been expanded. It also now allows users to sync their contacts and calendars directly to their iOS devices over USB. That was something that we lost, and a lot of people were really upset about. You were kind of forced into iCloud for syncing contacts and calendars. You can now do that directly over USB again. You will need the iTunes update 11.2.1 to go along with this, and that 0.1 is important. I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. The 10.9.3 update also improves the reliability of VPN connections using IPsec, resolves an issue that prevented Fontbook from installing PostScript Type 1 fonts, improves reliability of copying, editing, and inspecting permissions on files over an SMB file server, improves the reliability of your network home directories, also improves stability when installing configuration profiles, improves the login speed for users in Active Directory groups. So it looks like a lot of compatibility issues if you're in a mixed network over SMB or using Active Directory, those sorts of things, and includes the latest version of Safari 7.0.3, and that's the one with all the latest security updates. So that's pretty important if people hadn't upgraded their Safari yet. But unfortunately, 10.9.3 also came with a pretty nasty bug that impacted some users. And I wanted to point this out in case you have been impacted by this and you aren't aware of the fix. Apparently, after upgrading to 10.9.3, some users were noticing that their users folder and their users shared folders went completely missing. So you couldn't get into your users folder. I mean, that's a huge, huge deal. The folks over at the Mac Observer actually realized that the bug seemed to be related to iTunes 11.2 and anyone who had Find My Mac turned on on their Mac. So if you upgraded to iTunes 11.2 and you were using Find My Mac, that's actually what was causing this folder to disappear, and it wasn't directly related to the 10.9.3 update. quickly there came out several workarounds. I think Mac Observer actually mentioned a couple of them where you could run some terminal commands and that would actually get those folders back or the visibility of those folders back, but you would lose that visibility on reboot. Luckily, Apple was made aware of the issue and responded very, very quickly with a second update to iTunes 11.2.1. That update does resolve this problem. So if you were impacted by that, if you're missing your users folder and your users shared folder after updating to iTunes 11.2 and you use Find My Mac on Mavericks, you're going to want to grab the 11.2.1 update. So speaking of iTunes 11.2.1, that is the current version that's out and available on Software Update Now. So if you haven't upgraded yet, you should be fine to upgrade both 10.9.3 and iTunes 11.2.1. iTunes 11.2.1 brings improvements to the overall performance and stability of iTunes, something that's always good. It also brings a number of improvements to the podcast section and specifically podcast browsing. It now adds an unplayed feed and saved these unplayed feed and saved tabs that you'll see when you're browsing podcasts. That means you can quickly find all the unplayed episodes that you have of a particular podcast. You can also access the full feed by clicking on the feed tab. And then from that feed tab, you can actually stream or download individual episodes that you may have missed, or maybe you want to go back and review. And then you now also have the ability to save versions of podcasts or specific episodes. So if you find a particular episode that you really like, you can click on the save and that will show up on the saved tab and will be there on your hard drive and on your Mac for future listening. So some nice enhancements and updates to podcasts, which I'm glad to see. I you know, if you listen to the show, you know I've been questioning, you know, where Apple is going with podcasts and what they're doing with it, but it looks like they're giving it some of the love that it needs. So that was nice to see. Lastly, in iTunes 11.2.1, there's also a fix for an issue where iTunes may become unresponsive when updating Genius. So you can get both the iTunes update and the update to OS X Mavericks through the Mac App Store, clicking on the Updates tab. You can also go into the System Preferences and click on Software Update to access that, download it. And also, both of these updates are available through Apple's support website at apple.com/support. And then along with Mavericks and iTunes 11.2, they also updated the podcast app on iOS to Podcast 2.1. It resolves playback issues after syncing iTunes and improves stability when downloading podcasts. That's good. Added Siri support, so you can now actually get Siri to play your podcasts. You can say play podcasts, or you can ask Siri to play a specific podcast. So if you say play Maccast Enhanced, for example, and Siri will happily start to play the latest episodes from the Maccast. So that's really, really cool. And of course, you can do that with all of your podcasts. And I'm happy to see that Apple is doing more Siri integration. I think that maybe gives us a little hint that they are trying to expand Siri functionality. Again, I'm hoping to hear more about that at WWDC, as I mentioned earlier. Some other nice new updates to the podcast app. It now has the ability to automatically delete episodes after they're played, so that should help with the management. I'm always having to go back in there and, you know, manually swipe and delete the old episodes, so that's going to save some time. And it brings some of the same features that they added into iTunes, things like the ability to save episodes. So now if you have an episode, you can click on the little info icon and you'll notice there's a new save episode option, then that will save it on your iOS device. You can also, again, browse older episodes and download them directly to your device. And the update to the new podcast app also adds support for Apple's new CarPlay features, which are coming to some of the new model cars. If you're like me and have an older car, though, Pioneer has just demoed its Apple CarPlay integration with its next dash systems. Model numbers 4000 to 8000 of the NEX or next dash systems from Pioneer are going to be updated sometime this summer to support CarPlay. So that is now in the podcast app, and it'll be able to integrate with the CarPlay systems that are built into 2014 models of Honda, Hyundai, Mercedes-Benz, Volvo, and Ferrari, as well as the aftermarket system, both from Pioneer and Alpine. And in 2015, Apple has a number of other car manufacturers who have committed to supporting the CarPlay system. If you go to apple.com/iOS/CarPlay, you can get all the information and details and see the full list over there. But pretty excited to see Apple doing doing that. Oh, and another cool feature that's in the new podcast app is the ability to share podcasts through AirDrop. So you can actually send your favorite podcasts over to a friend via AirDrop and introduce them to some new shows, maybe like the MacCast. I appreciate it if you would do that. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know, I am a big fan of all the apps that Smile makes, but one that I've been using a lot more lately is PDF Pen Scan Plus. I went paperless a couple years ago. I'm, you know, trying to use less paper and more just for organization and kind of to be able to keep track of all my documents and all the bills and receipts and taxes and all that stuff. I went totally paperless. But one of the biggest hassles is actually getting the paper documents into some sort of system, into whatever management system you use, be that, I know people who use Evernote, I use Paperless from Mariner along with my Fujitsu ScanSnap, but a lot of times I'm out and about and actually just remembering to get that paper into the system when you get home from a business trip or having to take the time to run it through your scanner, all that stuff, that can be a hassle and documents pile up. So I think one of the keys to being paperless is being able to get paper into a paperless system as quickly and easily as possible. And PDF Pen Scan Plus lets you do that. And more importantly, it lets you capture it right when you get the paper. So the minute you get that receipt after paying for a business lunch, you can snap it with PDF Pen Scan Plus and get it into the system. And then it syncs up to iCloud. It can sync into your favorite service like Dropbox or Evernote, Google Drive, Alfresco, all right from the app. And they just updated the app to version 1.3 and added a bunch of great new features. They have an improved user interface. It's even better than it was before. It was good before, but it's gotten even better. They've made it really easy to get multi-page scans in, so you can just snap, 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 and get a multi-page document in and do all of the post-processing and image editing right there within the app. It now adds new paper sizes, so they already have custom paper sizes now for receipt, default A4 letter, legal, whatever your paper size is, you can kind of preset that. They also have support for custom paper sizes. It does the OCR, which is key. That gives you the ability to search your scanned documents. It does it right within the app, and you kind of get this nice little animation that shows you as it's doing the OCR. But now it has a new feature where you can actually view the OCR text right over your document. So you can see what it converted, see that OCR text, and it's amazing how it works. It's really, really cool. And they have new scanning and cropping features. It's much more precise than it was before. Again, it was good, but it's gotten even better. And they have improved OCR accuracy, especially for OCR where the text layout is a little bit funky. And it's just $6.99 in the US App Store. So really worth it. Saves a ton of time. Makes sure I get my documents in when I receive them so I don't forget about it. I love the app, PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get it on the App Store. Check it out. And also be sure to check out all of Smile's other great applications, PDF Pen for the Mac and iOS, also Text Expander and Text Expander Touch, along with Disk Label. You can get all the information on PDF Pen Scan Plus, plus all the other applications over at smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. One of the cool things that's been happening here on the MacCast lately is that we've grown our international audience. And I don't know if that's because I've become more of a regular on the British Tech Network's Mac show. I have a feeling that plays into it a little bit. But certainly when I talked about NFC and more specifically about chip and pin and tap to pay systems and all these rumors that the next iPhone might have NFC support, I triggered something with a lot of you. I had mentioned that here in the US, we really don't use those systems. We're kind of still stuck on the old swipe and sign kind of system, but I got a ton of great feedback from the rest of the world about chip and pin. And a lot of you, I think, are kind of laughing at us, and I think maybe deservedly so, for using this antiquated sign and swipe system. Many of you point out that the whole chip and pin or the tap to pay for you know, lower cost transactions is much more convenient. It offers lower fees and more importantly has better security than some of the swiping systems. And for things like lower transactions, transaction amounts, a lot of you have said for maybe transactions under about US $25, you don't even need to enter the PIN. So it's just like here we have, you know, some places where you can go, you can swipe your card and you don't have to sign. With this, you don't even have to swipe. You just kind of wave your phone or your device or more typically your payment card near the little NFC receiver. And then you just pay and go. And we have the same kind of systems here. PayPass was one that many of you mentioned. We have it here in the U.S., but I've always been discouraged from using it at any retailers. Most of them tell me it just won't work at all. I think it will. My theory is I think it will. I think they just don't want to deal with it if the technology kind of goes south. But at least one listener from Australia sent me a really interesting picture along with their card. So when they got their new credit card, they got a little sticker that actually had the little chip embedded in it. And it said you could take the sticker and attach it to the back of your cell phone to use it for payment. So meaning that you now have basically what amounts to an NFC cell phone without that you can use for payments without actually having to have it either built into the device or, more importantly, without having to pull your wallet, you know, your card out of your wallet. You can leave that in place and just take your phone out and then use it on the whole tap to pay kind of system. And I think to some degree that only proves my point about why I think NFC is not really the technology I want to see sort of adopted moving forward. I get all of these benefits. I get that for payments, for a lot of transit systems, I guess internationally will allow you to, you know, pay for your ticket with the NFC system or tap to pay. And I get all of that convenience, but the technology itself, I think, has some underlying issues. One is that a lot of it's proprietary. So PayPass is one system that's adopted pretty, you know, pretty widely, but it's not exclusive. And different card companies, so Visa or MasterCard, different banks kind of hone in on different systems. So it's still kind of fragmented. And a lot of you have admitted to me, even internationally, that, you know, there are kind of some different systems. And every once in a while, you'll come across a terminal or a payment area that doesn't support the system that or chip that you have. And that adds some inconvenience. I like this idea of being able to slap a chip onto an existing device, but again, I think it proves the point that it doesn't have to necessarily be integrated. And I think that's what I'm getting at. And I'm also getting at that Apple's system, I think the system that Apple would be developing would be more universal, would be designed to be more sort of open. And I'm thinking Apple could use some sort of combination of iBeacons. And I know iBeacons are kind of a marketing term that Apple has honed in on, but basically that's just low energy Bluetooth, which is a standard, something that would attach to my iTunes account. Apple already has a copy of my credit card, so there's an added layer of security there because my credit card is being processed, but through a system where only Apple has access to that data and information. And it also means that I don't need any kind of special chip. I don't need NFC at all. It's just low energy Bluetooth, a beacon that would recognize where I am, where I'm paying, and allow me to pay directly with my phone. I could even not have my card on me because I don't need the card. I just need my iTunes account in essence. And that way it kind of gets around this. It doesn't matter which card I have, which bank I have. It's just going through Apple's system. Now, you could argue, well, it's still proprietary because this is Apple's system. But if a number of retailers start to adopt this, and I think the power behind this is that Apple has so many registered credit cards because of iTunes, that it could be a system that they could open up and anybody can sign up for a free iCloud account. Anybody can sign up for an iTunes account for free and they can get into the system. And it takes a lot of that complexity out of it. So I think Apple's going to go a completely different direction. And I don't think NFC is going to be it. About the only argument I heard for NFC in an iPhone is that maybe some of the chipsets that Apple is already using to do wireless communications, things that are already doing the Bluetooth, might have support for some of these NFC systems that are already out and in place. If Apple can add that fairly easily and give you the ability to use those payment systems with your iPhone, they may open that up, but I think Apple's going to want to have a little bit more control. Historically, they've wanted to have a little bit more control over that. The U.S., it sounds like, is going to be moving toward a chip and pin and more of a tap-to-pay system in the future, and I think for a lot of the security reasons, you know, we've had so many breaches in security and so many problems with the swiping system that it makes sense. And a number of the card companies, I think Visa and MasterCard, have targeted sort of a 20, I want to say 17 was the last date that I heard, date for sort of converting over. So I think we're moving in that direction. But I think Apple is looking at a payment system that's going to be completely different. And we've been hearing that Angela Arendt, who is in charge of Apple's retail, is now pushing for some sort of payment system. I just don't buy that it's going to be tied to NFC or chips or anything like that. I think it's going to be Bluetooth and iTunes and that sort of thing. But that's just my theory. Again, this is a great conversation we're having. I'd love to hear more about what you're thinking. Shoot me an audio comment. Send me an email. Let me know if you agree with me or disagree with me. Something else that I also brought up on the last episode was that we're quickly approaching the next version of Mac OS X. Actually, we should hear a little bit about it at WWDC. And if you're paying attention to the numbering scheme, you know, Apple moved from the big cat names to these location names. So we have OS X Mavericks. Some people are thinking the next version might be OS X Yosemite, but underlying that is the version numbering. So we're currently at 10.9. The next version should be 10.10. So we have Mac OS X 10.10. And I jokingly said, well, that's a lot of 10s to be Mac OS X 10.10. And Larry actually had the perfect solution. He emailed me and said, well, you know, you could just refer it to it as Mac OS X cubed because we have three 10s. And I love that idea. So I think, hence, from this point forward on the MacCast, the next version of Mac OS X, 10.10, will be referred to simply as Mac OS X cubed. So what do you think? I like that idea, and that's what I'm moving forward with, unless you tell me otherwise. A question came up on the last episode, or rather, we had a listener who was having some troubles with an older printer, and he had gone to his printer manufacturer and asked them if they were going to have updated drivers for Mac OS X Mavericks. He was having to stay on the older operating system because at his office, he needed to connect to this pretty specialized printer, and they had told him that that Apple was responsible for updating the printer drivers in OS X Mavericks, and I called that into question a little bit because it was my understanding that, yes, Apple is distributing printer drivers through the software update utility, but that manufacturers simply just need to develop the drivers and then submit them to Apple for inclusion in the operating system. And listener Beans pointed me to the actual Apple support article, HT3669, in case you're interested in the number. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But that article pretty much confirms what I thought on that last show, that vendors just need to submit their driver updates to Apple, and then they would be rolled in and included in software update, because what that article has is a full list of all of the updated and supported printers and drivers that are in the operating system. But the reality is that Apple does not have to write, and actually won't write, drivers for printer manufacturers for the operating system. They can still have those on their own. And I have a feeling that if they signed up for Apple's developer program and just signed their drivers, that they could also distribute them directly through their website. But that article does have that updated and extensive list if you want to look it over and see if your printers are supported in the latest version of the operating system. But another interesting thing, we were trying to help this listener out and get this older device connected. That article also mentions that you can try using some of the generic drivers that are included with Mac OS X. So if you have an older printer and it supports PostScript or PCL, there are generic PostScript and PCL drivers provided in the operating system, so you can select those. They're available from the print using pop-up when you're adding a printer. So when you go into the system preferences to add a printer, look under the print using list and look for generic PostScript or the PCL drivers, and you can select those and see if that works with your older printer or device. You will have limited functionality, so you might not get all the advanced features of your printer, but you might be able to get at least basic printing support back in that device. And in my opinion, limited functionality would be better than no functionality at all. You may ultimately end up deciding you have to go with a newer printer, but it might be able to get you by for some time. So I thought I'd mention that as well. And a big thank you to listener Beans for pointing us to that article. Mike emailed me recently to ask a question about Safari, and specifically about resetting his top hits list in Safari. And I guess when I originally read the email, I was a little bit confused because Mike, and I apologize for this, I emailed you back and said, oh, well, that's pretty simple. All you have to do is go into Safari's reset menu. So if you open up Safari, go into the Safari menu and choose Reset Safari, you can check the Reset Top Sites option and click the reset button, and there you go. They'll be reset. Well, Mike was actually asking about top hits, not top sites. And for those of you who don't know, because I got a little confused on the distinction too, top sites, if you go in Safari under history, you can choose the show top sites button, and then you get that grid of all the sites that you visit most frequently or have visited most frequently, and that's tracked through your history. The top hits that Mike was referring to is part of the smart search bar, the URL field in Safari. So when you start typing, what you'll notice is it'll pop down and it'll make a bunch of different suggestions, and those are actually divided into different sections. The first one is going to be top hits, and I guess that's some sort of list that Safari creates based on the search results from your preferred search engine. So for most of us out of the box, that's going to be Google, unless you've changed it to Bing or Yahoo. But it kind of performs a search, finds the top hit, and then presents that to you in the little drop down. And so Mike wanted to know, how do I reset that sort of top hits list? And I did a little researching into this, and Mike, what I found was that I think it's populated a couple different ways. I think somewhat from your browsing history. And so to remove that data, you might try just going under history menu and choosing reset history. From there, you can click OK, and I think that'll wipe out the history, and then I think it'll wipe out any of those past sort of top hits searches. The problem is that even after clearing that, I think it still goes out to your default search engine, and whatever the first result is, it will pop that into place. And then as you do more searching and browsing and stuff like that, it kind of tweaks that top hit to be more personalized towards your search results. I'll just mention real briefly here too that if you go into history, reset history, you can also reset your top sites from there. There's a little checkbox that'll pop up in that dialog that says reset top sites. You can check that and reset the top sites list from there as well. So you kind of have two places. You don't have to just go under Safari, reset Safari. But the top hit feature can also be disabled. So if you don't want to have it at all, if it's just bothering you, you want to get rid of it, Mike, what you can do is you can disable it from the preferences. So if you go into the Safari menu, go into preferences, and then click on the privacy tab, down near the bottom, you'll see a checkbox or a section that says smart search field. And there is a do not preload top hit in the background option. You can check that. And that, I think, will stop the top hit from actually loading in the background. You also have an option to disable the search engine from providing suggestions at all in that smart search field. So if you don't want it popping down and suggesting different sites, you can check that one in addition. And then I think it'll turn off both of those features. So you can play around with those settings and see what kind of results you get. I played around with them a little bit, and it seemed to still pop up some information and data. So I might not be 100% clear on what's going on there. If anybody has some additional information or has played around with this and can provide some insight, let us know. But Mike, I would play around with those features and see where they get you. All right, and then finally for today, I am going to try and tackle a mystery, a problem that has plagued iOS owners, Mac owners, iTunes users, iPod users, iPhone users, anybody who has had to deal with iTunes and music on a Mac or with an Apple device. This is a mystery that I think plagues us all and will probably go unsolved, but we're gonna try and do it anyway. I received an email from Hugh, and guess what? He's been having issues with the album and song artwork in his iTunes library. In his case, this time around, it went missing, but this could apply to missing artwork, mismatched artwork, jumbled artwork. I've had all of the problems, and I think we all have. If you've used iTunes and music at all, you know this gets messed up. I'll have podcasts that have completely the wrong album art for whatever reason. But in Hugh's case, what was going on is iTunes would drop his album art. It would just not be there. And he found that going into the file menu and just simply clicking get info and then canceling seemed to fix the problem for a little while, but then the issues would return and the album art would go missing again, and it was getting really redundant and repetitive and time consuming to have to keep doing this little hack around. So he's actually looking for a more permanent fix. And I'm not sure I'm going to have a permanent fix for you, but I've sort of come to the conclusion with all of this that most of the problems seem to come between some sort of conflict between the album art that Apple wants to give you and the album art data that you've added on your own. So it's sort of the generated stuff that comes from the iTunes store and the stuff that you have. And I think this gets mismatched and jumbled. And I think part of the problem is that under the surface, it appears that Apple handles the two differently. So if you do the whole file get info thing, and then you go to the artwork track and you have artwork pasted in there or applied in there, that is the stuff that's embedded in the file, in the actual file, in the metadata. At least this is what I think. If you select a track in iTunes and you right-click or control-click on it and then you choose the Get Album Artwork option, the artwork is actually downloaded to your Mac and stored in your home folder in the music library in the iTunes section in an album artwork folder. And I think a sort of a reference is set up in the iTunes metadata kind of pointing to that file. So it's actually not embedded in the file itself. And I think if any kind of corruption happens, if any kind of disconnect happens in that metadata, that's when things kind of go south and these sorts of conflicts can arrive. And I think there's a similar sort of reference structure set up in your iOS devices as well with the artwork. So if you're using iTunes Match and some of these other devices where it's pulling the album artwork down and just sort of pointing to it, I think things get broken. If you're really finicky about your album art, and a lot of us are, you know, I like to have the right artwork for the right album, and a lot of times the stuff that Apple pulls down is totally mismatched. It's either the wrong thing or it's just sort of off. You know, they give you the greatest hits album artwork rather than the original album artwork. That happens quite frequently to me. It's really frustrating. I think the way you can most often avoid the problem is by actually doing the embed method, saying, this is the album artwork I want, put it right into the metadata of the file, and leave it at that. Apple, don't mess with it, don't touch it. And I think the good news is, I think for the most part, Apple will defer to that embedded artwork first. I think it tries to use that first, and then if it can't find that, it tries to use whatever it can find through iTunes and through these other mechanisms. And if you're like me and you use iTunes Match, that sort of just makes the problem even worse, because if you're not syncing the actual files to your device, it's going to try and pull and use whatever artwork Apple has provided. Luckily, again, if you're using iTunes Match, iTunes Match is supposed to default or defer to your metadata first. So if you've gone in and you've adjusted album or album names or titles or artist names or any kind of metadata, it's supposed to put that into your iTunes Match, iTunes in the cloud library, and defer to that. So I think overall you can fix all of this by doing a couple things. First, you have to clear out the Apple data. And you can do that by selecting a group of tracks or an album in iTunes, and if you right-click or control-click on it, you can choose the clear downloaded artwork option. That is going to get rid of any artwork, I think any of that reference artwork that Apple has put into place. It's only going to remove the downloaded artwork, that stuff that's in that iTunes album artwork folder. It's not going to get rid of any of the embedded artwork that you've already put into place. And as a matter of fact, if you had embedded artwork there and it was already being superseded by whatever Apple downloaded, I think it'll fix that issue. It'll go back to using your embedded artwork. After clearing that artwork, what you're going to want to do is then embed your own stuff if you haven't already. And you can find your album art if you don't have it, if you're not scanning it in yourself. A good place to look for it is I'll use Google Image Search. You can also try albumart.org or the Album Art Exchange. Those are a couple good sources. I'll have links to both of those in the show notes at maccast.com. The key here, though, is that if you're using iTunes and especially an iOS device, Retina artwork needs to be 1400 by 1400 pixels. That is a huge piece of artwork. Can sometimes be hard to come by. You can fall back to lower resolution, but the higher resolution, the better, and you kind of want to target 1400 by 1400 pixels. But find the artwork, and then I usually just in Safari will control click or right click on the image and just copy it to the clipboard. But if you're using iTunes Match, you're going to want to make sure that you disable that first. So you're going to have to turn off iTunes Match before you do this procedure and then turn it back on. Because again, once you've updated the metadata, you want iTunes Match to have your new embedded metadata with those images and things like that. You want that re-uploaded to iTunes Match. So temporarily disable iTunes Match, reset any data, artwork data that's already there. And then when you re-enable iTunes Match after re-embedding your own metadata, it should clean stuff up. So to add your own album artwork, once you've kind of done the reset, turned off iTunes Match, what you're going to do is you're going to find the artwork you want, copy it to the clipboard, then select the album or the song in iTunes and choose File, Get Info, Command I is the keyboard shortcut, and then go into that artwork section and paste in the artwork. Once you see the artwork in there that you want, click OK, and then what you should see is a little processing window pop up. Let it process, embed that information, that data into the actual file, then you can close the Get Info window, and obviously repeat this procedure for all of the album artwork that you want to clean up. Once you've done that, you can turn iTunes Match back on if you use iTunes Match, and that should take care of your album art data. Now, I'm not going to promise that it's not going to get messed up again at some point in the future, because I've seen this happen over and over again, and you may have to repeat this procedure at some point, but it should get you further along than you are, and will hopefully, Hugh, help with the issue that you're having right now. The last thing I want to mention before finishing this up is that there are a few applications out there that can help you find and apply the album artwork a little bit quicker. If you don't want to have to go through this whole search process and Get Info and copy paste, there's a few applications that can go kind of directly into your files and into your iTunes library and help you clean this stuff up. One that I'm aware of and have never used is called TuneUp. It will actually help you also update your artist and song, title data, all that other metadata along with your artwork data. The other software that I have used just for album covers is Cover Scout from Equinox. They have another application called Song Genie that will do the song and artist and album and other metadata, and you can use the two together, but Cover Scout is specifically designed to help you go out and find album covers and apply that data to your iTunes library. So those are a couple little apps that you can buy and use to kind of make the process a little bit easier. But however you do it, I think the point is get the actual album artwork embedded in the files and then make sure that on your devices you're actually downloading and using the files. With streaming an iTunes Match, I'm not really sure how it pulls that artwork, if it'll use the metadata or not. I'll have to do some additional testing with that. But there's a couple things you can try to kind of actually clean this stuff up. So I hope that helps you out, Hugh, and thanks for your question and your email. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. And be sure to check out PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can OCR and get your paperless documents right into your device, into your system from your mobile devices, from your iPhone and your iPads. Really great stuff. Check it all out over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for listening, for staying subscribed. If you have any feedback for me, you have a comment, a question, you can shoot me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on our voicemail line. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you'd like to leave voicemail on Skype, my Skype address is the MacCast. And for show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can go to the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/the MacCast. And I'm also on Google Plus. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you'll find us there. But with that, that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.